just like we can't expect someone with a broken leg to walk as if they were able-bodied, we can't expect someone with a traumatized brain stuck in hyper or hypo arousal to be able to think clearly or respond effectively or function to the best of their ability.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, the Executive Director, and today we're very pleased to devote an entire program to discussing an important method for healing trauma with the use of a therapy called EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. We're constantly reminded that we're confronting a mental health crisis in America, especially with regard to our youth. Society seems beset by mass shootings and acts of violence daily, which compound the large-scale trauma already inflicted by the pandemic. Young people in particular often lack the funds to pay for their medications or to get mental health therapy. Well, EMDR seems to offer hope to many trauma sufferers, and it has been garnering great interest for its and credibility as an efficient and effective treatment option. EMDR was discovered in 1987 by psychologist Francine Shapiro, who found a novel method for getting people's thinking brains to work together with their emotional brains to resolve symptoms of trauma. Since then, it has provided healing to countless sufferers of PTSD and other stress-related problems, ranging from depression, chronic pain, anxiety, and addiction. What's more, it appears to be able to fast track healing in a limited number of sessions, which makes it more cost effective and within reach for countless trauma sufferers. Well, it's time to introduce today's guests. We have with us two wonderful people, an internationally renowned expert in EMDR, Dr. Debbie Korn, who has a private practice in Cambridge, Mass, and who has co-authored a new book on the subject. She's joined by Michael Baldwin, her co-author and a communications professional in New York, who credits EMDR with saving his life after decades of unsuccessful talk therapy. And I ought to tell you, the name of the book is Every Memory Deserves Respect. Okay, welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
So the great thing about this book is it is very clear and understandable, not in a simplistic fashion. But some of the facts in this book blew me away. One was this quote: emotional abuse and neglect carry greater weight than other widely recognizable forms of child abuse. So here I was, and I'm sure many others, thinking, oh, child abuse, you know, that's terrible. You inflict something upon this child, yet ignoring or neglecting a child can be even more harmful. That really surprised me. And some of these things manifest, we know now, in illnesses much later in life, physical illness.
Yes. So trauma certainly does affect our whole well-being, mental or psychological and physical. There was a very famous monumental study known as the ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. I think it was around 1995, 96, 97. They clearly demonstrated that adverse childhood experiences are highly predictive of health and psychological problems across the lifespan. So according to this study, maltreatment, emotional, physical, and sexual abuse or neglect, and household dysfunction in childhood contribute to significant psychological issues later in life. Depression, anxiety, illicit drug use, alcoholism and alcohol abuse, suicidality, 1 in 3 diagnosed mental health conditions in adulthood directly relate to ACEs. The longer the exposure, the greater the number of ACEs, these adverse childhood experiences, the more significant the medical and psychological impact. From this study and all of the later studies that replicated earlier findings, we know that for people with high ACE scores, high levels of trauma exposure, health issues and medical disorders can manifest decades later. So here we're talking about chronic diseases such as cancer, stroke, heart disease, COPD, and diabetes, among others. An ACE score of 4, which means exposure to 4 major events on this ACE questionnaire that was part of the study. An ACE score of 4 was associated with 2 times the risk of receiving a diagnosis of cancer, a 4-fold increase in emphysema, and a 7-fold, 700% increase in alcoholism, which I think are staggering statistics.
It truly is. The other thing that surprised me in the book was it said trauma is passed down from family to family. So it's intergenerational, which I just really was shocked at that. So some of us are, maybe many of us, are damaging our children unknowingly through, you know, untreated trauma, not even knowing. Would that be true to say?
Well, yes. Parents who don't have the opportunity to heal from their own traumatic experiences run the risk of parenting in ways that wind up negatively affecting their own children, right? Parents with their own trauma histories may struggle with rage or impulsivity or depression. They may find themselves parenting in the same way that their abusive or shaming or neglectful parents parented them, even though they swore that they would never do that. And because of unprocessed trauma, they may teach their children that they need to be afraid in the world and refrain from trusting anyone. So there is that risk if, as parents, we don't address our own unprocessed trauma, that we can move that trauma along to the next generation.
What I think is wonderful about this is you're actually naming this, because I think so few people would link those things, you know, looking at their behavior and saying, I don't know why I fly off the handle, or I don't know why this happens, have never probably thought that it's as a result of this deeply suppressed problem or many several problems that they had in childhood. Mm-hmm. So it's great to know, A, that you can identify this, and B, you can do something about it.
Yeah.
This is why I'm so delighted about that this book is getting read. Okay, if anyone's joining us, we're actually talking about EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which is a form of treatment therapy for treating trauma, a very effective method. And we have 2 people with us today, Dr. Debbie Korn, who is a practitioner in EDMR, and we also have Michael Baldwin, who actually has been a client who has had transformative progress in his life through being a person that actually underwent this, is undergoing this. So Michael, welcome. Let's move over to you.
Thank you, Mary.
So in this book, you are incredibly open and graphic, really, about the trauma of your childhood, which masqueraded as this perfectly privileged middle-class upbringing. So first, let me applaud your bravery in coming out with all this stuff. And I think you prove that trauma affects the entire well-being, as Debbie was saying, physical and mental. So tell me, growing up, how did you hide the after effects, the PTS symptoms, and try to pursue what appeared to be quite a successful career in advertising?
I guess to set the stage developmentally, my trauma history, which I was unaware of as an adult, started with the bedrock. The basis really was about neglect and abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, physical abuse. And also what Debbie refers to as attachment rupture. So I wasn't able to attach to any of my 2 primary caregivers, which is like being unattached in space, just floating as a child, because I had no one to turn to, I had no one to lean on, I had no one to be giving me what I deserved as a child. I'm talking about pre-verbal as a starting point. So that was kind of my crucible. As a result, you know, I developed a conviction that I was worthless. And that, as I got into adulthood, turned into a strategy of grandiosity. So I became a status and achievement junkie, a 24/7 workaholic. And even though I, as an adult, would have these recurring nightmares, even though as an adult, I was dealing with phobias, even though I didn't know what a phobia was. I was so entrenched in this grandiosity, status achievement track that it was all completely eclipsed. I mean, when I had to write my story for Debbie, and I was going into all that whole aspect of my life as an adult, it was exhausting, the lengths to which I went. You know, running the Boston Marathon, but not walking a step, getting myself into medical school, and then not going, you know, and on and on and on, and monogramming anything that moved, and, you know, my apartment and my car and belonging to clubs. It was just pervasive and exhaustive. And I look back at that person, I don't know who that person is. So in answer to your question, it was fully encompassed me. And there, and because I didn't even know I was a trauma survivor to begin with, I wasn't even aware. I was just fully blinders on, status achievement junkie, grandiosity strategy.
But you also suffered from things like panic attacks, even though you didn't know why. You had all these aspects that you were kind of hiding. So when did you start going to therapy? Just because you did a lot of therapy before you found this.
I started in my 20s, and by the time I met Dr. Magnavita, Dr. Jeffrey Magnavita, who is my therapist, so everyone is clear, Debbie is my co-author, she was not my therapist. He was the eighth therapist I saw over about 22 years. And the one consistent thing leading up to Dr. Magnavita was no therapist ever mentioned the word trauma to me ever. None of them knew anything about EMDR, including myself. And by the time I got to him, I was really at my nadir. I was really at the bottom. And I think looking back, I think it was immediately evident to him when he laid eyes on me. I was lucky in the respect that my older sister recommended him to me, even though I lived in New York and he was 110 miles away in Glastonbury, Connecticut. She said, are you serious or not about getting help and healing? And then it doesn't matter what the logistics are.
So how long ago did you discover it, EMDR?
March of 2020, I believe. March 24th, I think it was the actual day. Funny how I remember that. Mm-hmm.
You seem to derive benefit quite quickly from the initial sessions. And first, if you could talk about that, and then as a part of it, perhaps you could tell us how it's improved your life and what you're left still working on. I think you repaired an abusive relationship with your brother, your older brother.
Yeah. So from the first appointment or session I had Dr. Magnavita, I had palpable concrete relief. I mean, I think he thought I was exhausted by the time I left the first time I saw him, but I felt like I had two extra quarts of lung capacity because I felt stuff had been moved out of my being. That had been there so long, because we really started, you know, at my pre-verbal existence, and just tides and tides of yearning and longing and unhappiness and neglect and deprivation just poured out in an experiential way, not in a verbal or intellectual way, but in an experiential way. And that was a consistent hallmark of every session I had with Dr. Magnavita, who also, by the way, employed things other than just EMDR, although we did EMDR every time I was with him. And for me, starting with the dismantling of this facade that had been built so, you know, fastidiously over the years, it basically, I guess the best way I can describe it is, my operating system prior to that was around fear and anxiety and dread and uncertainty. And the operating system I ended up when I finished with Dr. Magnavita was about waking up in the morning and just being, and about having relationships with friends that were intimate and authentic. And the thing that you mentioned about my brother, who was a really sadistic and brutal physical bully to me my entire growing up. I mean, relentless. And anyone who's knows about bullying knows that you live in a state of terror all the time. You never feel safe. I also had a bully at school I had to deal with. So we never had a relationship. As far as I was concerned, we would never, until our mutual deaths, would ever have a relationship. And as a result of this work of EMDR with Dr. Meg DeVita, I reached out to David, letting him know the book was coming. My brother's name is David. And he said, you can say whatever you want about me in this book. I just hope that, or the idea that we might finally be able to have a relationship as brothers, brings me joy and delight. And that was probably a year and a half ago. We've had a Zoom call every hour, every Friday since then. We had our very first week together as brothers in Vermont a couple of weeks ago. The Monday of the week was my brother's 70th birthday. So that's how long we waited. And it was the most remarkable experience. And he right now is the most important person in my life, where I never thought I'd have a relationship with this person ever in my life.
Wow. Well, that's very uplifting for everybody and gives us all cause for hope, I think. So that's really quite good. There's a whole story about trying to get health insurance to pay for the cost of this, which you actually took on as a sort of a personal crusade and won at eventually.
Yeah.
Why was it so important for you to get recognition, proper recognition for this treatment?
I was determined, on behalf of these younger parts of me, to never give up and not take no for an answer, because I knew I needed help and I knew that the EMDR path was the right one. And I knew that in my network, they didn't even have an EMDR therapist. They were referring me to like herbalists and like, you know, these people who did dog training. I mean, it was beyond, it was ridiculous what they were doing. And believe me, it was a challenge. It took me 13 months, but I was just not going to give up on behalf of these guys, which were me, because I wanted to be the person representing them, because when I was them, there was nobody. I had nowhere to go, no one to turn to. And so I was really determined. And it was a passionate, even for me, who can be very tenacious, it was a passionate, you know, long process of what I went through, but it was worth it because they ended up paying 100% of my cost for Dr. Meg DeVita over 2 years.
And of course, you've opened the door now for people coming through after you, which is
correct,
which is huge, huge. Okay, back to Debbie. Let's look just at what happens in the brain when someone's exposed to trauma. So there are three parts: thinking, emotional, and instinctual.
So as you said, it's helpful to think of the brain as being made up of three smaller brains: the thinking brain, the emotion brain, and the instinctual brain, as you see in the diagram. The thinking brain is responsible for thinking and talking, remembering, reasoning. The emotional brain responsible for feeling and remembering, detecting threat, interacting with others. And the instinctual brain is connected to sleeping, eating, breathing, etc. And in response to trauma, the emotional brain, in conjunction with the instinctual brain, mobilizes and winds up hijacking the thinking brain. The limbic system of the emotional brain goes into overdrive. The sympathetic nervous system automatically kicks into high gear, and everything gets focused on survival. The alarms blare. And the brain prepares you to fight or to take flight, right? Heart rate increases, pupils dilate, airways open wider. We become hyper-focused, scanning for danger, looking for escape routes, sometimes freezing when the threat feels particularly overwhelming and there's no possibility of escape. And the thinking brain's executive control network gets suppressed, cutting the thinking you, out of the decision-making loop. And ideally, after a trauma is over, the thinking brain is able to reestablish control. But in many cases, particularly when there's a diagnosis of PTSD, the emotional brain remains stuck in overdrive and continues to inhibit the thinking brain's functions. People remain in high alert and particularly reactive to anything that reminds them of the trauma. And the brain is not able to effectively evaluate whether someone or something is a real threat or not. And with prolonged or repeated exposure to trauma, this state of high activation, what we call hyperarousal, freeze, fight, flight, becomes chronic, leading to anxiety, difficulties with self-regulation, irritability, aggression. And sometimes when the level or the duration of stress becomes too great, a person's nervous system shifts into a shutdown or collapse mode, what we call hypoarousal. And many complex traumatic stress disorders reflect this chronic state of immobilization, right? It shows up as despair, as hopelessness, numbing, dissociation. So just like we can't expect someone with a broken leg to walk as if they were able-bodied, we can't expect someone with a traumatized brain stuck in hyper or hypo arousal to be able to think clearly or respond effectively or function to the best of their ability. Yeah. We can no more act normally with an injured brain than we can walk normally on a broken leg.
That's put very nice and clearly. Coming back to the therapy now for a moment, how then does EMDR help people to access those memories locked in the nervous system?
Well, we begin with the distress, the symptoms and the triggers in the present. And we ask clients to focus their attention on images, sensations, emotions, and thoughts. And as they attend to their body-based distress, which is not something that is typically addressed in talk therapy, we ask them to float back to a time where they experienced something similar. We ask people to think about the first or the worst time. We often have people that float back to experiences that they haven't thought about in decades or incidents that they didn't really think were so pivotal. And sometimes I have people bring in photos from various times in their life and we use them to access memories. But when people are motivated, when they understand the link between these memories locked in their nervous system and the symptoms they're experiencing, when they're motivated to explore those memories and they're ready to heal, it isn't so difficult to find them.
Interesting. And of course, what we're doing is rewiring the brain in a way, because you say that neurons that fire together wire together. So we want to separate or reposition the neurons and the synapses. So that's neuroplasticity. So we know the brain can do that.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So yes. Different outcomes, different reactions to things.
Yes. Right. Neurons that fire together wire together. What this means is that we have thousands of associations that have become wired in our brain, which is mostly a good thing, right? Things that have gotten coupled together, linked. So think about it. I say roses are red and you say
violets are blue.
But this concept also explains how triggers become wired to trauma memories. As a result, every time we encounter a trigger, it activates the spontaneous replay of a memory. And that in turn further strengthens the neural connection between trigger and memory. And trauma survivors grow anxious when confronted with reminders of past traumas. And over time, that fear generalizes to more and more situations. These new situations, they eventually create their own unique neural pathways, connecting present day people, places, and things with trauma-based fear reactions. And trauma survivors walk around with outdated, problematic associations. For example, intimacy equals abuse. Love is coupled with being controlled. Alcohol is coupled with relief. And as such, very often trauma survivors find themselves repeating patterns that they know on one level are not healthy or even potentially dangerous. So returning to an abusive relationship, picking up an alcoholic drink, shutting down or remaining silent, freezing like a deer in the headlights, beating themselves up for not being perfect, right? All of this reflects, you know, these associations that have gotten coupled and need to get uncoupled.
So we know Michael is certainly a living testimony to this effectiveness of this treatment. What is the success rate like? And of course, it's hard to measure how many sessions it takes to heal, because someone's written in here, is there a difference between healing and cure?
You know, everyone wants to know how long does treatment take? And, you know, it's hard to say what the average length of treatment is for somebody working with an EMDR therapist, because it depends on so many things, as you said. But early research showed that 90% of adults dealing with a single episode trauma, right? A car accident, an assault, were able to eliminate or significantly reduce their PTSD symptoms in 3 or 4 sessions. And there's a research study with Bessel van der Kolk that I was involved in back in the early 2000s, comparing EMDR to Prozac in the treatment of adult PTSD. 8 sessions of EMDR compared to a comparable period of time on Prozac. EMDR was ultimately superior to Prozac in reducing both PTSD symptoms and depression. By the end of treatment, all of those in the EMDR group had lost their PTSD diagnosis, right? All of those, along with 75% of those with childhood trauma histories. 6 months later, at follow-up with no additional EMDR treatment, almost 90% of the childhood abuse survivors had lost their PTSD diagnosis, and a third were completely asymptomatic. We were blown away, right? So long after the EMDR treatment ended and there was no additional treatment, the brain continued to right itself. The brain continued to process and people got even better. And it's worth mentioning that a recent meta-analysis looking at gold standard research studies determined that it's the most cost-effective of the 11 trauma therapies evaluated in the treatment of adults with PTSD. And with regard to success rate, there are more than 44 randomized controlled trials, RCTs, demonstrating the effectiveness of EMDR for PTSD in civilian adults. So it's considered an evidence-based top-tier treatment for this condition. It's strongly recommended as a treatment for PTSD in the treatment guidelines of organizations around the world, right? The World Health Organization, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, the American Psychological Association, Psychiatric Association. And finally, in addition, evidence is mounting in support of EMDR therapy for PTSD in children and adolescents, EMDR for acute PTSD reactions associated with recent trauma, treatment of combat PTSD, unipolar depression, chronic pain, and complex PTSD.
Michael, in terms of your own journey here, what things are you still left working on?
So lately, I don't know if this will sound corny or naive or what, but you know, why am I here? I am here to love and be loved. And that phenomenon has eluded me in the most core application pretty much my whole life. And I look now at the relationship I have with my brother, which is as intimate as any relationship I've ever had. So in terms of what's remaining, I think that for me is the first and final frontier where one therapist I saw along the way said, everyone wants to be able to answer the phone and hear someone say, hi, it's me. I don't have that person right now, but I'm now very consciously opening myself up to anything and everything. So the possibility of ending up with a person like that, a partner for me, is going to be a reality in my lifetime, which I think is probably the most important thing I can think of.
Well, I think just thinking you're lovable is the first step, just getting to that. Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, Mass Cultural Council, the Cambridge Community Foundation, and of course you. So if you want to donate or sign up to our list, please visit the website, cambridgeforum.org. Thank you all for joining us, and I hope to see you all soon.